Hello and welcome to The Lesson. My name is David Cowlishaw and in my day job I'm a teacher. But in this podcast I allow my guests to teach me about anything they like. No matter how obscure or unusual the topic, my guests will give a lesson on their specialist subject and you and I will be their attentive pupils. How they want to run their lesson is entirely up to them. All I ask from you is to leave your preconceptions at the metaphorical classroom door, settle down and enjoy the lesson. For this episode, my guest is published historian, history teacher, and fellow podcaster, Alexander Clifford.
Right, so 20th century Spain in six statesmen. Well, at the start of the 20th century, Spain was really kind of backwards, declining nation. If you'd gone around kind of rural southern Spain, which was the poorest region, you'd have still been able to find silver coins from the Roman Empire in circulation. Spain didn't have much going for it by Western European standards. It was poor, it was underdeveloped, and the political class had come up with a system called the Turno Pacifico, where you had two parties, the conservatives and the liberals, and they each alternated in power. This Turno Pacifico, peaceful turnover, they each took turns basically. You might have 3, 4, 5 years of the conservatives, and then you'd have the liberals for 3, 4, 5 years. Now, it was supposed to be a democracy. So how do you make sure that the conservatives or liberals win in the right order? By rigging the election, of course. So what you had in each town or village was a cacique, a local boss or landowner, or sometimes even a priest, who was told by Madrid, all right, your constituency in this election is going to produce a liberal candidate or a conservative candidate. And so they would bribe, they would intimidate, they would, you know, say, oh, well, you're going to vote conservative this year or else you're going to lose your job. They would get buses of people, pay them a day's wages and just drive them from one polling station to the next in order to produce the results that the government had decided was going to happen. So the ruling class kept power to themselves and just alternated and knew, well, if I lose power, I'll be back in a few years' time. And it was all kind of run like that. Now, that obviously wasn't a great system and corruption was kind of endemic. So at the start of the 20th century, you got a generation of politicians who labelled themselves regenerationists, that they were going to somehow improve and turn around the country. And the leading one from the right, the conservative kind of strongman of conservative Spain, was a guy called Antonio Maura. Great man, great moustache. He believed that all people in Spain were innately conservative and Catholic. And so if actually everyone was allowed to vote freely instead of being told how to vote, then they would always vote conservative. So he came to power in 1907 on this ticket of he is going to reform Spain, he's going to sweep away the corruption. Ironically, his election win was probably the dirtiest on record in terms of the corruption to get him into power. When he tried to reform local government as a starting point, unsurprisingly, the parliament was full of MPs whose power rested on this corrupt system and had no interest in reform. So you ended up getting all his attempts to reform being drowned in amendments and filibustering, things like that. And he lost power within a couple of years because he went and tried to crush protests using violence. And he really threw his toys out the pram, did Maura, at that point, and said, look, this system's corrupt. I hate the Liberal Party. I'm not going to ever rotate power with them again. A few years later, when it was time for the Conservatives to rotate with the Liberals, he refused. He turned down the premiership. He said, no, I think this is all facade. And what happened? Well, another member of the Conservative Party accepted the premiership, a guy called Eduardo Dato, the man of Vaseline, slippery character. And so the Conservative Party abandoned Maura. And that kind of sums up the kind of early 20th century of Spain. It was corruption. It was incompetence. It was politicians who said they were going to change everything and never did. And you didn't really get any kind of solutions or radical changes, I guess, to this corrupt system until 1923, when there was a military coup. And a guy called General Miguel Primo de Rivera took power. Primo de Rivera, I think, is a great dictator name, by the way. Primo regime always kind of rolls off the tongue. Now, Primo was a general, obviously, and he hated politicians. And, you know, fair play, given what the caliber of Spanish politicians were. But he really presented himself on a kind of drain the swamp, get rid of corruption, I'm not a politician kind of platform. He was, to put it kindly, unsophisticated, a bit of a populist. He once said that he learned his politics in the casino. He liked women and alcohol mainly, and he kind of talked in the language of the average man on the street. And his promise was, I'm going to reform Spain. I'm going to be what they called an iron surgeon, and I'm going to ruthlessly cut out the corrupt and decaying parts of our political system. So what he did was he appointed an army officer to run each kind of area instead of a cacique, a local boss. But that didn't work. In the end, these officers tended to either come to an accommodation with the local elites or else become the new cacique themselves. There was a kind of economic boom in the 20s, and he did win a colonial war in Morocco, did Primo. And he was a very kind of benevolent dictator. He, for the first time, the socialist movement was brought into kind of some sort of political power. And they were tasked with managing worker relations and kind of improving working conditions. And for a right-wing nationalist like Primo, he had a new constitution drawn up and then dismissed it because it was too authoritarian. There was a coup attempt against him by a mixture of army officers and politicians and anarchists even. And instead of arresting the people involved, instead of executing the people involved, what Primo did is he gave them each a fine on the basis of their income. So a poor working class anarchist activist might be fined a few hundred pesetas, whereas an aristocratic politician was fined half a mil. And the end of Primo is very kind of almost pathetic in a way, because when he realized he'd lost all his popularity by 1930, he resigned and he went to live in Paris until he died.
Drunk with enthusiasm, they danced the fandango, sang the Marseillaise, commandeered the trams, which packed inside and out, toured the town. The appearance of any of the leaders was a signal for even greater outbursts of cheering and flag waving, of which, by the way, there must have been an unending supply of all sizes, ready for the day. It is only fair to say, in all truth, that having regard to the magnitude of the revolution and the excitability of the Spanish race, serious disturbances and casualties were very few, the number of killed and injured being only 8 in such a revolutionary centre as Barcelona. The task that awaits Spain's new rulers, when the shouting and the cheering dies down, is a great one. Liberty-loving Britain and the whole world will wish them well in their endeavours. The army, navy and police, after a short resistance, were soon sporting the red brassard and good-humouredly watching, without interfering, the destruction of anything royal and the complete triumph of the revolutionaries.
And after Primo, you got a republic, a democracy for the first time, but it really struggled to ensure stability, and it was amongst the time of the Great Depression. Obviously, there was a lot of problems in the 1930s. The leading figure on the Spanish left at that time was a guy called Francisco Largo Caballero. Now, Largo also has a great name. He was in his late 60s. He was known as the Spanish Lenin, but he wasn't really like Lenin. He wasn't ruthless. He wasn't determined. He wasn't very good at politics, to put it frankly. In a series of blunders, he had kind of derailed the Spanish Socialist Party's political fortunes over the course of the 1930s, and the instability eventually led to a civil war, the Spanish Civil War, breaking out in 1936. He finally got a shot at being prime minister when the civil war broke out, and in my honest opinion, I think he was pretty incompetent and useless. He was visited by the American journalist, a communist journalist called Louis Fisher, and in the meeting, you know, Fisher was suggesting all these things that the Republican government needed to do to fight this war against right-wing military rebels who tried to overthrow the left-wing government. And he suggested that the, you know, the trade union workers, instead of building, they were still building apartment blocks when the enemy was closing in, they should be made to dig trenches. And Largo said, but if I tell them that, then they'll leave my union and join the anarchist party. And eventually Fisher was being so critical that the Spanish foreign minister, who was also in this meeting, kicked him under the table and said in English, because Largo didn't speak English, said in English to this journalist, you know, stop being so mean, he's going to get upset, you know, please. So, you know, Churchill he wasn't, and he lasted about 9 months as a war leader. And the Republicans, the left, lost the Spanish Civil War. And I think Largo really sums up some of the flaws of the Spanish left at that time. Now, after the Spanish Civil War, the man who came to rule Spain for the next nearly 40 years was General Francisco Franco. General Franco had led the military uprising against the left-wing Republican regime, and he had won the Civil War, and he basically made himself dictator for life. He was a veteran of the kind of colonial wars I've alluded to. He was pretty brutal, ruthless character. His regime executed at least 150,000 people, and he, you know, ruled with a pretty iron fist. Now, the interesting thing about Franco as a politician is he was a bit of a chameleon. He metamorphosized a number of times over the course of his long dictatorship. In the 40s, he was best pals with Hitler and Mussolini of Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy. But by 1945, that was a pretty bad look. He was the last fascist standing. The rest of them, you know, had been killed, overthrown, whatever. And he was there ostracized as this kind of freakish relic of a bygone era. They were denied membership of the new United Nations when it was set up after World War II, so Spain was a real pariah state.
First anti-democratic government to be outlawed by the United Nations is Franco's Spain. The days of this sort of swashbuckling parade are fast running to an end, as the last of Europe's fascist dictatorships starts on the downward path that leads to history's dustbin. Even the salute wasn't original. Banners, mass parades, swaggering phalange party members, they were all a shoddy imitation of Franco's late unlamented sponsors, Hitler and Mussolini. A world sick of militarism is glad that the United Nations organization has teeth, and that phalangist Spain is to be the first offender to peace to get bitten. Justice catches up with General Franco. These shots show the days of his success. He had a good run for it while it lasted. And now the democratic world is tired of him and the system he represents.
So what Franco's regime quite cleverly did was it kind of rebranded. He changed his image from being a fascist to being an anti-communist, the sentinel of the West, a guardian of kind of Western civilization against Bolshevism. He basically painted himself as being, oh, I was anti-communist before it was cool. And so in the context of the Cold War and McCarthyism, America kind of looked at this guy and thought, whoa, this guy could be our friend. This guy's an anti-communist. Spain would be a great base for us to have our military forces. And so the USA really bolstered Franco's regime, and its economic aid kind of saved the Spanish economy that was really struggling in the 1950s. Then in the 1960s, Franco and his regime kind of rebranded again, this time as the bringer of prosperity and stability to Spain, because they really jumped on the bandwagon of the explosion in tourism. You know, you got air travel becoming popular for the first time really in the 60s, and Spain turned itself into the destination of choice for holidaymakers from particularly Northern Europe, Germans, Scandinavians, and of course Brits. And they really, you know, they even kind of rebranded and renamed regions of Spain as things like Costa del Sol, which would be really easy for those English to understand what it means. You're going to get warm weather. Places like Benidorm were really built up in the 60s and early 70s by the Franco regime to draw in basically money, foreign money. And so when Franco died in 1975, his regime you know, had gone from being a kind of cruel fascist dictatorship to trying to paint itself as like almost like a tourist holiday rep. But nevertheless, Franco, of course, died, and there was a big question about what was going to come next. What came next was a surprisingly rapid reform of Spain into a democracy. Franco's successor was a member of the royal family who was crowned king, Juan Carlos, and eventually he chose as his prime minister a guy called Adolfo Suarez, who is without doubt my favorite person from history, called Adolf. Adolfo Suarez was a kind of career bureaucrat, a kind of Francoist creature of the system, who'd held different posts in the regime. For a while, he'd been director general of the state TV network. And when he was appointed prime minister, at the time, he was actually head of the Falange, the Spanish fascist party. So I like to think of him as history's most democratic fascist, because when he came to power as prime minister, he kind of got where the political wind was blowing and decided that the best approach would be a kind of blitzkrieg democratization. We're going to reform Spain as fast as we can to outmaneuver both our opponents on the left, but also the kind of so-called bunker, which was the hard right of the regime, who were called the bunker because they were thought to still be in Hitler's bunker as if it was 1945. They were living in the past. So what Suarez did through a series of referendums was reform Spain really very, very quickly and turn it from a dictatorship into a democracy. He legalized the other parties. He promised the generals, the hardcore bunker lot, that he wouldn't legalize the Communist Party. And then he just did. He held free elections less than a year into power, which he won because he was this kind of suave, sophisticated, very good on TV, because after all, he had been a TV man. Politician, a bit of the Hugh Jackmans about him. And he, with power, he passed a new constitution. He gave Catalonia and the Basque Country autonomy. He normalized relations with the trade unions. He passed an amnesty law, which basically forgave everyone on left and right for everything that they'd done in the civil war and the dictatorship, which is pretty controversial now, actually, because it means that no one who committed crimes under the dictatorship ever got punished. But then after a few years, Spaniards realized that democracy doesn't actually solve all your problems. And there was unemployment, there was inflation, there was Basque terrorism. And Suarez's popularity really nosedived. He, by 1980, was this increasingly isolated political figure. He had bad teeth. He had real problems with his teeth. That meant he had to have a series of operations and was basically living on painkillers. And he became paranoid about the potential of a coup. And the last hours of his political career at the top as prime minister was him sitting in parliament in the process of being removed as prime minister, when the army stormed in with machine guns, started machine gunning the ceiling, saying, you know, get on the ground to all these democratic politicians. And Suarez was basically the only guy, you can watch the footage on YouTube, Suarez is the only guy sitting there on his chair while everyone else is running or hiding. He's just sitting there looking depressed because it's all over. But actually that was a kind of, in a way, a career high as well, because the attempted military coup was an abject failure.
Durante el asalto de los golpistas al Parlamento, Adolfo Suárez mantiene en todo momento una actitud ejemplar. Es el presidente del gobierno y demuestra su entereza, valentía y compromiso con la democracia. No se refugia de las balas. Y mientras Antonio Tejero habla desde la tribuna, él ofrece una imagen serena. Se enfrentó al teniente coronel de la Guardia Civil con determinación pero sin aspavientos, y no sería la única vez aquel 23 de febrero. Durante las 18 horas que estuvo secuestrado el Congreso, Suárez se llegó a encarar con Tejero.
And now we kind of get to Spain, modern Spain, if you like, is a democracy. And the man who came shortly after Suárez was a guy called Felipe González. The best way to describe him, I think, would be a kind of Spanish Tony Blair, but 10 years before Tony Blair. He moved the Spanish Socialist Party away from Marxism towards the centre ground. And he was really very popular. He was seen as kind of young, handsome, the man of the future. And he won a landslide in the 1982 election and would be prime minister for the next 14 years. And he kind of dragged Spain into the modern democratic Western world, creating a universal healthcare system, pensions, giving rights such as abortion and divorce. and also taking Spain into the EU and into NATO. On the other hand, kind of some similar criticisms to what may be leveled at Tony Blair might be that he kind of threw industry under the bus and he didn't really do much about kind of poverty and unemployment. Worst of all, though, was the corruption under Gonzalez's premiership. There was a huge amount of scandals to do with cash for influence. You could basically go to the Socialist Party offices as a businessman and pay to get government policy changed in your favour. And the very worst example was an organisation called GAO, which was a secret police kind of ring that assassinated people that the government didn't like, mainly Basque terrorists, it must be said. It wasn't political opponents, but it was obviously very illegal. And two police officers took the fall for it and were sentenced to 100 years in prison. But then in the early 90s, it turned out that these men were each being paid $500,000 pesetas a month into secret Swiss bank accounts in order basically to take the fall on behalf of the government. And so Gonzalez basically drowned in corruption and lost power in 1996. And that kind of takes us to the end of the 20th century. In Spain, it's been on a bit of a roller coaster of democracies and dictatorships and civil war and political instability. I guess the running theme through it all and the thing that makes Spanish history so fascinating is that you've got political extremes, yes, but also political incompetence and corruption on scale that is just kind of sometimes mind-blowing for a Western nation to kind of put up with. But yeah, like I say, I think, you know, it's a great story. It's a real roller coaster, and there's some fantastic kind of characters that are really fascinating.
Okay, Alex, thank you so much for that lesson. A hell of a lot to cover in a short period of time, but we managed to blitz through 100 years of Spanish history there and just about come out the other side. And it is remarkable. It is remarkable that Spain still exists as a country in many respects, because that was the overwhelming feeling, I thought. Just right-wing morons, left-wing morons, and then we get to the Spanish Tony Blair, and I think, right, things are about to calm down now, right, probably? And yet, no. centrist morons as well, they exist on all sides. There's, like, so many different areas we can talk about, but I guess perhaps given the sort of the fascinating history of political corruption and outright murder and horrible dictatorships Spain has experienced over the last, in the 20th century, it's not seen as a sort of country with that kind of history now. By that I mean sort of Spain is sort of generally regarded now, I would say, as your tourist hotspot, a sort of nice Western, modern, democratic country. Is that partly Franco's incredible rebranding of it, or is it just collective ignorance on the part of perhaps UK, observers?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, isn't it? Look, I think I wouldn't say ignorance, you know, because I think most people don't know about Spanish history, and you know, they're not taught it in school. I wouldn't expect you to be able to run me through the leaders of 20th century Spain. But I think what is fascinating when you actually get into it, and I think part of it is what you say is a really successful rebranding project by Franco's regime in the 1960s. To kind of drop the image of being a dictator or some kind of cruel, oppressive ruler to being, the land of sangria and bullfighting and basically nice beaches. And that was a really successful rebrand job. You had, by the end of the 60s, early 70s, you had something like 35 million tourists a year going to Spain. At the start of that decade, it was, I think, about 1 million. So Spain, for most people, I would say, in Britain at least, is exactly that. It's a holiday destination. And they did a really good job of making it that and turning places like Benidorm into this tourist hotspot to bring in the cash that just was not coming from other sources.
You alluded to Basque separatists towards the end of your lesson there, and more recently there's been the sort of protests and sort of semi-uprising in Catalonia. To what extent is Spain this fractured kind of jigsaw puzzle that needs to be sort of smashed together? Or do you think it's mainly, is it just those two regions who are a bit of sort of, I don't know, the problem children, if you like?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and it's something that I didn't, I guess, in the lesson really go into that much. Spain is a very kind of regionally diverse country. I would say much more so than, say, England. Each region of Spain, one of Gonzalez's reforms actually was to make each region an autonomous community with kind of self-governance. So it's a kind of federal structure, but each region has its own quite distinct character. And, you know, the ones that are the most distinct, we kind of know the Basque Country in Catalonia that you mentioned. And they are very, very different. You know, they have their own language, which with the Basques in particular, but also, to be fair, the Catalans, is not just like an accent in Spanish by any stretch of the imagination. It is very much its own language. And they have their own regional identities that really, over the course of the 20th century, became accentuated partly in response to the extreme Spanish nationalism, which did see and still sees these kind of separatist movements as an attempt to destroy our homeland, attempt to break up Spain. I would say much more than in Britain, where kind of Scottish independence, I think a lot of English people are fairly kind of neutral about. In Spain, it's a very emotional kind of emotive topic of how dare these people want to break up the homeland. The interesting thing about the 20th century is that with Catalan and Basque kind of grievances, this century was really where those things took off. I mean, there wasn't even a word for the Basque Country in Basque until the 1890s. There wasn't a flag for the Basque Country until a similar time. In fact, I don't think Basque was really written down until the early 20th century. So the Basque identity is really kind of, and Basque nationalism has come on leaps and bounds. And that was expressed in the 60s and 70s through pretty large-scale terrorism campaigns. Although it must be said the terrorism was targeted at kind of regime figures. They assassinated, for example, one of Franco's last prime ministers, a guy called Luis Carrera Blanco. But those questions, as you've alluded to, really remain unsolved.
Going back to Franco then, you mentioned how he sort of evolved his regime, if you like, to sort of maybe move with the political winds and not be seen as this sort of Hitler in Spain sort of figure. And he lasted 40 years. Now, how much of his sort of longevity was down to the sort of iron fist, old style, you know, your classic dictator tropes, and how much of it was perhaps the Spanish people grew to like some of the things he did?
That's a really good question. And I think it's a case of change over time. The first kind of 10 years were really quite, unquestionably brutal. More than 100,000 executed, probably more than 500,000 imprisoned. You had a lot of people fleeing the country into exile. You had concentration camps and labor camps. And, you know, in those situations, it was ruled by an iron fist, and it was really kind of opposition was crushed. It was impossible by the late 40s to organize resistance because of the level of brutality, and not just kind of putting someone in prison or executing them, but blacklisting them. You know, if you were a teacher in any, or, you know, a university lecturer, or in any way actually worked for the state, and you had kind of anti-regime views, it was found out, you'd be blacklisted, you'd lose your job. And so that coercion was always at the foundation of the regime. It built the building blocks of the regime in the 40s. Over time, you know, there's no question that it got less harsh. There was less people put up against a wall, but you've still got plenty of people going to prison, being tortured. And in this really unrest really rose in the late 60s and early 70s. And I think that's partly because actually you had a generation of people who had enjoyed the prosperity, perhaps had moved to cities from the countryside because of the rising prosperity, you know, rural to urban migration. But that triggered unhappiness because as people get a bit more wealthy and move to cities and there's kind of more communication, then political dissatisfaction can grow as well because people tend to see, well, how come I'm not, you know, living with my freedom of expression and rights and freedom of assembly when, you know, by the 60s and 70s, they can see on TV what it's like in other Western nations. And it's really, they feel like it's really not fair. And you also have a situation where as there's rural to urban migration, people, you know, ended up getting into overcrowded housing, you know, low quality accommodation, poorly paid jobs. And that triggers unrest as well. So I think kind of definitely Franco had his supporters, there's no doubt. And definitely people, when Franco died, were afraid of what might come next. And they were afraid of losing the positives that had come from the regime. And that's probably why you ended up having a regime man being the one who underwent the transition to democracy.
Do you think there's still that sort of maybe, you know, how sort of older generations can sort of get a bit wistful about, you know, situations that were, if you put them under any kind of microscope, actually quite horrible. Is there still perhaps this maybe yearning for, maybe not Franco, but, you know, parts of the Franco regime by elements of the Spanish people now?
100%, yeah. The Franco, because there was no, like, reckoning, you know, Hitler was, you know, defeated in a war and killed himself, and there was denazification. Similar thing happened in Italy. But Franco, you know, died of old age and the regime evolved into this democracy. So there was never a reckoning. There was never any trials. There was never any kind of accounts being settled, if you like. So that means that, there's definitely in Spain a kind of, I think among some people, both old and perhaps not old enough to remember the regime, a nostalgia. At the same time, there's people still alive who were tortured by the regime. You know, there's cases of people who live on the same street as their torturer, but who's never gone to prison because, you know, there was never any trials for anything that was done. So it's very, very divided, very polarized in Spain attitudes towards Franco. But I think, you know, you see this in Eastern Germany, what used to be, you know, the old DDR, the old East German regime. There's a very noticeable trend there of nostalgia, of people nostalgic for the simpler times of the DDR. And I think, you know, there's always going to be nostalgia, isn't there, for something in the past where something's perceived as better. But definitely in Spain, there's a real kind of sharp political divide on left and right as to, you know, the right-wing party in Spain, the main right-wing party in Spain, you know, was founded by former members of the regime. So they have a kind of, you know, whilst not endorsing Francoism, they might point to the more positive aspects, whereas people who suffered under it are going to say, no, it was god-awful. Mm.
Now, you've written two books on the international brigades in the Spanish Civil War. Now, I think there's a million things we could talk about with the Spanish Civil War, but I suppose for perhaps the layman who doesn't know much about it, they sort of know that maybe it was a very sort of a left v right sort of thing, and Franco ended up winning. But I think the international brigades are perhaps something that aren't so well known. So could you maybe sort of summarize, like, first of all, how you became interested in them and sort of what their sort of what their significance was?
Well, I became interested in the Spanish Civil War partly through chance, really. In my first year of university, you got assigned to a different historiography seminar with different lecturers. And I was put in a class where we were looking at the history of the bombing of Guernica and the different rival stories that came out about the firebombing of that city that was immortalized in the Spanish Civil War by the painting by Picasso. And one of the most interesting aspects when you're looking at the Spanish Civil War outside of Spain, you know, as a you know, from the English-speaking world, for example, is the fact that thousands, more than 32,000 people from around the world, about 50 different countries, voluntarily went to fight in the Spanish Civil War for the left-wing Republicans. And it's a really kind of, you know, interesting story, and I literally, you know, could speak for hours on it, and I, you know, got to limit myself here. But what I would say is that you got this idea in 1936 when the Spanish Civil War started. It really captured the imagination, particularly of the left around the world, as being, look, all the great debates of our age, democracy against dictatorship, fascism against socialism, are literally being played out in combat on Spanish soil. You know, these political debates are being fought, and we've got to be a part of it. And there was also a big sense, because Hitler and Mussolini both supported Franco in the Spanish Civil War with troops and weapons, there was a big sense that, hang on, you know, the fascists are on the march. They are kind of taking over Europe, and we've got to stop them. And of course, this was the time of appeasement, where Britain and France were doing not very much about Hitler. So I think volunteers as well who went to Spain thought, I'm going to be fighting fascism and trying to stop the fascists kind of taking over Europe. And also, you know, thousands and thousands of the volunteers in the international brigades were Germans or Italians or people from places like Austria, Yugoslavia, Poland, which had right-wing dictatorships. And they either lived in exile or they left their home country to think, right, well, I can't fight my dictatorship at home, but I can fight, you know, I can fight Hitler in Spain. I can fight Mussolini in Spain. Particularly bad experience, I would say, for the Austrian volunteers, because if they left in 1936 or 1937 to go and fight in Spain, by the time the Civil War ended, their country had ceased to exist because it had been annexed by Hitler, which must have been a strange experience.
Yeah, well, quite. As a sort of maybe a final question then, so I've known you for quite a while. I know you've got a huge interest in history and a lot of different topics within history. And I knew you'd written those books on the international brigades, but you chose to do the whole of 20th century Spain as your lesson for this podcast. Why did you choose to do that?
I chose to do that because I think it's a great story. Like I said, it's a roller coaster, and it's one that for a Western European nation, they had a very interesting 20th century. And the other reason is because there's those characters, you know. I really find it fascinating, the characters, and obviously there's a, you know, a great deal of detail you can go into looking at them. But, you know, Primo, the benevolent dictator who can't even bring himself to put someone who's trying to kill him in prison. You know, Maurer, the anti-corruption candidate who runs, gets into power through corruption. You know, Franco, the political chameleon. Suarez, this kind of suave Hollywood kind of TV man who somehow turns himself from a fascist into Spain's greatest Democrat. And obviously, you know, Gonzalez with his you know, Spanish Tony Blair image that I've given him, slightly ahistorically, but there we go. I just think, you know, I think the story of 20th century Spain is just endlessly fascinating, and there are just so many people who somehow are at the top of Spanish politics, and you just can't quite understand how and why.
Fair enough. And, you know, maybe people could draw parallels with some current political figures. That would be up to them. So, Alex, you, in addition to churning out books like they're going out of fashion, you also do another podcast yourself. Why don't you tell the listeners about your books and podcasts and things and what you do on those?
Okay, well, very briefly, I've written a couple of books about the Spanish Civil War. Primarily, I'm looking at the military history side of it. The most recent one, Fighting for Spain, is out now, and it's a damn good book, I would say. It's a damn good book. It's got loads of pictures and everything. But it's about the international brigades, and that if that 2-minute description I gave wet your whistle, then you can learn everything you could want to with that. My podcast that I co-host is called History's Most. And what we do is we each fortnight, we pick a different topic from history. Sometimes it's kind of me and my co-host speaking about it. Other times we get on expert guests and we apply superlatives to them completely unnecessarily. But, you know, so we do episodes like History's Most Guilty Man or History's Worst Democracy or History's Worst Friendly Fire Incident, History's Most Underrated General. You know, we just drop from different time periods and different topics, different people. And we kind of look at extremes of both brilliance and incompetence and tragedies and triumphs. And yeah, like I said, apply unnecessary superlatives to them. If you enjoyed my kind of 15-minute tour through 20th century Spain, then we actually covered 20th century Spain in a lot more depth in a series of episodes within the podcast. So we would welcome you over there to explore in more depth people like Suarez and Franco.
Dan Snow, eat your heart out. Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dave. Thank you.